Dodos, Dinosaurs and Unions, a nice cheery title. I'm not going to be talking a lot about dodos or dinosaurs, so you can leave now if you're really keen on those ones. But it's obvious that Australian unionism is in need of some revival. If you're talking about the proportion of the workforce that's in a trade union, that's fallen from about 48% in 1982 to the current rate in the low 20s. It was 23% in 2003. If you're talking about rates of industrial action, they peaked, I think the post-war peak was in 1974. Last year, or at least the 12 months ending September last year, saw the lowest rate of industrial action in Australia since records began, which is 1913. We're now at a rate at something less than 1% of the incidence of industrial action that we saw in 1974. So it's a very low ebb indeed. And of course, this has seen many of our enemies in the ruling class having, crowing about it, basically. The Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry last year applauded their success in eliminating strikes from the national psyche of most Australians, and they announced that we are now in a post-industrial action country. Well, I think the accounts of unions' demise are very much exaggerated. With 1.8 million members, unions are still easily the largest voluntary organisations in Australia. There's still a network of delegates across the country. And as the mobilisations against work choices showed us in the last few years, when union leaders actually give a call, workers are prepared to respond in their hundreds of thousands and in their millions. But, obviously, the unions have taken some very big backward steps over the last couple of decades, and my job today is to explain why that's the case, and by looking at history, I suppose especially, talk about the possibility for a revival in union activity. I should start, though, really, by welcoming people to Melbourne. If you're from interstate or from overseas, welcome to Melbourne. Melbourne, of course, this fine city is named after Britain's Prime Minister in 1836, at the time that the British state arrived here. Lord Melbourne had distinguished himself a couple of years before. People might have heard of the Tolpuddle Martyrs, six agricultural workers from southwest England who got transported to Australia in 1834 for the offence of uttering unlawful oaths, that is, trying to establish a trade union. They were prosecuted under an obscure act designed to stop naval mutinies, actually, but it was the best law that Lord Melbourne, as Home Secretary, then could find. And he pronounced that these labourers were guilty both of a conspiracy to control their masters and they were acting contrary to the laws of nature. So that's Melbourne for you. And one of these days we might get around to renaming the town New Tolpuddle or something like that from the martyrs. Oh, yeah, okay, we can take suggestions at the end. But but the point of mentioning that is just to say that, we've got to look at the long sweep of history. And, this is far from the first time that unions have felt themselves shackled by repressive anti-union laws. It's far from the first time that we've been in the doldrums. And I will be talking a lot about history in this talk this morning. But before I get into that, I wanted to cover a few points because people, like as well as historical arguments, people, you can find any number of theories to explain why unions should be put in the museum alongside, stuffed dodos and dinosaurs. And first of all, I think it's important to point out that this is far from the first time that you can find, theorists of different persuasions writing unions and the working class off. This is This is the earliest quote that I came across from a former workers' leader called Thomas Cooper. He wrote, "In our time, workmen's intelligence was demonstrated wherever you went. You would see them in groups discussing the great doctrine of political justice, or they were in earnest dispute respecting the teachings of socialism. Now you will see no groups in Lancashire, but you will hear well-dressed working men talk with their hands in their pockets of co-ops and their shares in them or in building societies." Thomas Cooper was writing in 1872, so this is, far from a new phenomenon, people saying that, well, the workers have been bought off or whatever. And you can find it, basically any decade since then. The 1950s, there was a whole lot of writers such as Anthony Crossland in England saying, well, these new generation of workers after the war, they don't work in the dark satanic mills anymore. They're in these clean petrochemical or aerospace plants. There's no way that these people will be involved in class struggle. Each generation of these theorists has been proven wrong. And I'd argue that people who say the same thing today can also be proven wrong in the future. I don't have time to go through a lot of the arguments that these sort of people make, but I'll sort of whiz through a couple of them. One, probably the silliest, but there's a whole session on it tomorrow, so I won't spend much time on it, is the argument that we're bought off somehow. And I guess my response to that is, well, I'd like to know where the bribe is, you know? If we're being, if we're so much better off than we were in 1982, well, where's my share of it? In Australia, workers' wages have risen on average since that time. They stagnated under Labor in the 80s and early 90s. They rose on average during the Howard years, but most of that increase was actually concentrated amongst, salaried managers and so on. You take them out, and actually it's a pretty paltry pay rise that we've got. And we've had to work harder and harder for it. The average working week in 1983, I think it was 38.3 hours. Today, it's somewhere over 42 hours. That's an extra 4 hours a week. Now, if that doesn't sound like a lot, multiply it out over a year, and it's about 200 hours. That's 5 standard working weeks extra that we have to work before we get our annual holiday. That's how much extra that we're working, because our side hasn't been fighting back in the class struggle as we should have for the last couple of decades. So I think we can dismiss that argument that we're all sort of bored off, happily sitting in our McMansions watching our plasma TVs or whatever. Second argument, which I think has a little more, it's worth exploring. I don't really have time to go into it, but people should raise it in the discussion if they want to, is the argument about globalisation. And that somehow, the globalised nature of production now means that there's such competitive pressure on workers that, that we simply, for one reason or another, can't go on strike. Now, again, this is not a new phenomenon. Henry Lawson could lament in 1889 that the mighty bush with iron rails is tethered to the world and, everything that flowed from that. 1889 was not the end of the class struggle in Australia. I'll break it to you now. In fact, many of the industries that have been associated with the real high points of militancy in Australian history have been the industries most tied to the world economy, such as the metal miners at Broken Hill, later generations of iron ore miners in the Pilbara, shearers at different times and so on. So it just doesn't hold that a globalised economy means a low incidence of struggle. I'm going to have to leave that there because time is on the wing. So the thing that I think all of these explanations have in common, though, is that they're cop-outs. And they're cop-outs by union officials and their apologists who really don't want to have a fight, explaining, trying to put that in terms that make it sound like we can't have a fight. Excuse me. But before getting into that, the history of this happening, I think we have to explain a bit about the role of trade union officials in a capitalist society. Because trade union officials are a fundamentally conservative layer, and that might sound like a little bit of a big call, because we know that there's left-wing ones and right-wing ones, but fundamentally, they're a group of people who have an interest in preserving capitalism rather than overthrowing it. And that's because of the role they play in capitalism as a layer that mediates between workers and the bosses. So if the bosses were ever put out of power, trade unionists would be out of a job. That's one way of putting it. Another way of looking at it is Marx's insight that being determines consciousness. What we do day by day, week by week, year by year, very powerfully affects how we see the world and what sort of views we have about it. And if you're a trade union official, what do you do day by day, week by week, year by year? You make deals. You make a deal with the employer. You get that deal ratified in the Industrial Relations Commission. You sell that deal to your members. You enforce that deal on your members. You talk about it with other union officials and the deals they're making. You become a professional deal maker, and the point of your existence becomes making the deal. Not necessarily the advancement of your members' wages and conditions, not necessarily taking people out on strike, certainly not people taking power into their own hands. The point is, you're making the deal. You do that day upon day, week after week, in the powerful legal structure that capitalism erects around unions, and that has a very powerful conservatising effect, thank you. I think goes a long way to explaining why union officials time and again will do their best to rein in the high points of struggle. And certainly we've seen plenty of that in Australian history, which I'll be going into. I think this is a really crucial point in our politics, and one that really, we can't understand much about what's happened in the unions without this understanding of the officials. So I'll leave it there, but people should really come back to it in the discussion if you want that fleshed out or have questions about it or whatever. But time and again, we've seen officials playing a conservative role, and that means that in order to push the struggle forward, one of the crucial things has been a layer of people with an alternative politics to the officials. And again, we'll see that in the history. And rather than take you through the entire history of the Australian working class from Total Puddle days to now, I've just selected maybe two or three, we'll see how the time goes, incidents to talk about times when unions have been, you know, forced into the doldrums, when workers, you know, have learned one way or another that they can't fight back, and then some sort of revival has taken place. The first example I wanted to talk about was of coal miners who in 1928-29 suffered an absolutely catastrophic defeat, but within a decade recovered to win some of the most you know, most significant gains ever recorded by certainly by coal miners and really by almost any trade union with, in a single dispute. Coal mining was the site of extremely fierce class battles in the early part of last century, and there's no shortage of there's no shortage of reasons why that might be the case. If you worked 40 years in a coal mine in New South Wales, if you spent your working life down a coal mine in New South Wales in the first three quarters of last century, you had a 1 in 24 chance of being killed on the job. So there's 50 of us here, maybe. If we'd all spent our working lives down a coal mine, that's two of us for sure that would be dead. You would have a 1 in 5 chance of suffering a permanent incapacity, that is losing a limb, losing an appendage, or losing one of your senses, being blinded or deafened. A 1 in 5 chance. So that's, if there's 50 of us here, that's what, another 10 of us that are blind, deaf, losing a limb, or whatever. And that doesn't include, you know, the supposedly less serious accidents, incidents, injuries. Between 1937 and 38, for example, out of 15,000 New South Wales coal miners, almost 6,000 received compo for injuries requiring at least a fortnight off work. There's a constant competitive pressure in the Australian coal mining industry in this time. The industry was plagued by overcapacity, it was subject to slumps all the time, and so there was a constant pressure on the workers to keep production up, even at the expense of health and safety and of workers' lives. And as the shallow boom of the 1920s gave way to the full-scale depression of the 1930s, the employers in the coal industry launched an all-out offensive. In March 1929, 10,000 Northern District miners, that's miners, coal miners around the Newcastle area, just north of Sydney, were locked out. 10,000 miners were locked out. They were not to be allowed to return to work until they had accepted a 12.5% pay cut, until they had accepted a clause saying there will be no industrial action whatsoever, even over safety. And one of the most important things, the coal owners demanded the end of pit top meetings. These are meetings that the miners have every morning before they go down. They can discuss health and safety or any other issue, or they can just decide, well, hell, I don't really want to go down that hole today. We're going home. And they wanted the abolition of those pit top meetings. This was in March 1929, and the lockout dragged on for 15 months. So if you can imagine 15 months without an income, on some sort, you know, they got a little bit of relief from the rest of the miners' union who chipped in. If you had a family, you were eligible for a very small relief payment in New South Wales in that time. Put together, that amounted to about half the minimum wage at that time. So you had whole communities, which were basically gutted, houses boarded up or burnt out for people trying to collect the insurance money. Whole tent cities springing up on the banks of rivers so that people could supplement their diet by fishing. You had families broken up as men, you know, tramped the countryside looking for work as the economy crashed into the depression. The union leaders throughout this 15 months took an essentially passive position. They took the case to arbitration. The Arbitration Commission decided on two occasions that the lockout by the employers was illegal. But the owners appealed to the High Court, and the High Court back to the owners. The union officials then put their faith in the election of a federal Labor government, sounds familiar, but despite promises to help the miners, when the Scullin Labor government was elected in late 1929, they didn't lift a finger and they let the lockout continue. In December 1929, the Conservative New South Wales government decided to reopen the Rothbury mine near Newcastle in New South Wales. And they announced that there was going to be worked by scab labour, you know, desperate men, basically, on the boss's terms. You know, on the 16th of December 1929, somewhere between 4,000 and 10,000 miners assembled at Rothbury to stop the scabs, and a pitched battle ensued. At least one miner, Norman Brown, was shot dead by the police, and many more dozens were injured by bullet wounds. Many more were beaten senseless. And some ended up permanently handicapped from the battle. the protest against, you know, the state action at Rothbury was extremely intense. Thousands of people rallied. Public meetings in the coalfields authorised the formation of a Labor Defence Corps, which at first muster some 1,000 miners, practised drill movements and the use of the bayonet. But the miners were unarmed, the state had a monopoly on violence, and they flooded the coalfields with police. The dole was withdrawn from striking miners on the basis that they refused to scab at Rothbury. Some people's meagre support went down. And the courts were full of miners. You can find accounts of one young member of the Communist Party copped 6 weeks jail for stating that police are murderers. Another was fined half a week's wages for saying police are scabs. One was fined the equivalent of a quarter of a week's minimum wage for describing God as a pretty clever joker for supporting both sides in every war. But that's a bit sort of incidental. And, yeah, you know, they found humour in the situation, but, you know, state terror and starvation, you know, there's nothing really funny about that. And after 15 months of holding out in defiance of the owners and in defiance, really, of their own union officials, they were finally starved back to work on the owners' conditions. This was a totally crushing defeat, obviously, and it happened alongside similar crushing defeats on the waterfront around the country, and especially here in Melbourne. There were fierce battles, again, people shot by the cops, and the timber industry as well. You know, three huge class battles, all ending in total defeat for the workers. So in the wake of that, the number of strikes, and with the onset of the Depression, the number of strikes dropped dramatically. The number of strike days in 1930 was only 5% of the rate that it had been the year before, and then it fell again by half in 1931. So, you know, the union movement was absolutely smashed. And yet by 1938, miners were capable of staging a six-week strike, which achieved, some really remarkable gains. They achieved the 40-hour week for underground miners, improved safety, for the first time paid annual leave, workers' compensation and pensions for miners. So how did that happen? During the 1929 lockout, the Communist Party was a very small organisation, very new organisation, quite inexperienced organisation, but they did have some members on the coalfields and did solidarity work and argued very consistently to spread the strike, that if the miners around Newcastle were left on the lockout by themselves, they would surely go down to defeat. So really what was needed was to extend that to a general strike. Now, they didn't have the forces to put that into operation. They didn't have the forces to make that general strike happen. But because they consistently made that argument, that won them a hearing amongst many coal miners and people in that community. There was also a general radicalisation going on at this time with the onset of the Depression and then with the rise of Hitler in 1932. Communists were involved in a variety of defence activities for unemployed people in suburbs like Collingwood and Fitzroy in Melbourne, in places like Newtown in Sydney. There were pitched battles between unemployed workers trying to stop evictions, bailiffs and landlords coming around to evict families. Communists played a leading role in trying to organise people to resist those evictions. They also organised relief workers. If you go out onto Swanston Street and look down, you can see the Shrine of Remembrance down the end of Swanston Street. That was built by Dole Labor in the 1930s. The communists got on that job and organized a strike. This is a strike of people on the dole, so they weren't being paid at all, which actually succeeded in winning the dole for the first time in Victoria, rather than some meager relief payments in return for work. So these struggles are really important, both in themselves, but also in giving experience to a whole bunch of activists that it was actually possible to fight and win, even on a relatively small scale. And as the economy started to slowly pick up, intermittently from the mid-1930s, more and more of these activists found themselves employed back in the mines and back in other industries. There was a dispute in Wonthaggi, at the state coal mine just down on the coast of Victoria here in 1934, that saw these communists put a new approach into organising. The dispute was over victimisation and sackings of miners who raised safety concerns, a variety of other matters. There was constant pressure on wages and conditions and so on. It came to a head, some people were sacked and the mine went out. The big difference was the communist approach to organising, and their philosophy can be summed up in the phrase, I guess, make every member an activist, where they really set out to, rather than keeping the rank and file passive and having the whole strike run from the officials, they really set out to involve every member in making that strike successful. So they formed what was called a broad committee, which wasn't just the union hierarchy, but involved, I think it was about 60 people on it from around the town, leading activists and so on. And a series of committees were set up to organise fishing, rabbiting, entertainment, distribution of food, speaking tours to Melbourne to raise solidarity and raise funds, entertainment for, the whole community, and so on and so on. A barber shop was set up that gave out something like 2,500 haircuts during the dispute, so everyone looked their best as well. And after, how long did it take? It was 4 months that they were out. And eventually the state government gave in, the sackings were reversed, and this was really a crucial turning point in showing that it was possible with the right sort of organisation and the bottom-up approach that they took and making every member an activist, that it was actually possible to win. Later in that year, in 1934, communists got a number of spots on the Executive Council of the Australian Miners Federation. And from there, worked to build up the miners' union strength towards having a major confrontation, which happened in 1938. So they engaged in all sorts of propaganda activities, convincing miners that, actually they, deserved better than what they were going. They were, they were pointing out that the same amount of coal was being dug in New South Wales in 1937 compared to 10 years earlier, but with, I think it was about 10,000 fewer miners, and there was a resulting rise in the accident rate and so on. There was propaganda about this. There was organisation of broad committees in just about every coal mining town. All of those sorts of, committees that involved people were set up on a massive scale across Australia. And the result, as I said before, a 6-week strike that was totally solid and, managed to basically start to cripple industry, cripple the railroads and so on, until eventually the coal bosses had to agree to their log of claims, which was, in 1938, an extraordinary result. Okay. So, that took a while, but I guess, the couple of points to take from it would be that, yes, unions can be rebuilt, even from a very dire situation. They're rebuilt from the bottom up, and crucial to that rebuilding can be a layer of people, with a vision of a different sort of society and an anti-capitalist politics and a commitment to take the officials on and make every member an activist. Okay. I'm going to have to gallop through the Clarioche story, which is a very similar one. People might have heard of the penal powers that were enacted by the Menzies government in 1956 that were, for more than a decade, held unions in shackles. There were, I think it was about $750,000 in fines that were levied against different unions, a similar amount in costs, and the threat of these substantial fines hanging over industrial action was used by a series of right-wing union leaders to say, well, you don't want the union sued out of existence, please go back to work, and so on. It really did have a dampening effect on the class struggle through the early 1960s. And again, in turning this around, it was direct action that played the crucial role, and it was communists who played a crucial role in that. In May, 15th of May 1969, Clary O'Shea, the secretary of the Tramways Union and the Bus Union here in Victoria, fronted the arbitration court over, I think it was about $13,000 of outstanding fines that the Tramways Union had failed to pay. As 5,000 shop stewards demonstrated outside the industrial court, John Kerr, the judge presiding, yes, that's the same John Kerr who sacked Whitlam 6 years later, John Kerr asked O'Shea to swear an oath. He refused. He asked him, Kerr asked O'Shea to produce the union's books so that this money could be found and taken from the union. O'Shea refused, and Kerr promptly sent O'Shea to jail. The result, well, this was the signal for 6 days of industrial action that involved more than 1 million workers in Australia, in every state. This industrial action was actually opposed by the Victorian Trades Hall Council, who issued a statement saying, "We advise unions and unionists that they are in no way obligated to participate in these unauthorised stoppages, as such action is contrary to the rules, procedures and decisions of the ACTU." But the left was sufficiently organised to say, "We'll stuff you," to the Trades Hall Council, and a series of general strikes rolled out across the country. Okay. The result was, on the Tuesday afterwards, there was a fellow, what's his name? Dudley McDougall, a former advertising manager at the Australian Financial Review, so a person with all the right connections, just announced that he had won the lottery and that he was paying the fine for Clary O'Shea to purge the contempt and paying the fines of the union. So from that day, the penal powers were not used anymore. And that unleashed a wave of militancy that peaked in 1974, as I said at the start of the talk. And that was responsible, that strike wave was responsible for a massive redistribution of wealth from capital to labour in those 5 years. It also resulted in a sharp lift in union membership from 2.1 million in 1966 to 2.8 million 10 years later, and halted what had been a 20-year decline in union coverage. And again, you know, it was the preparation that was the thing. In this case, one of the key roles was played by 27 unions in Victoria that had separated themselves off from Trades Hall in a more left-wing grouping that had campaigned consistently around the penal powers, and that had said, you know, for instance, one BLF organiser that Liz Ross, a member of ours, talked to, was saying, you know, for 2 years they were going around sites saying, the time will come when we are going all out to smash these laws. When Claire O'Shea was jailed, he was flooded with phone calls from job sites saying, is this it? Is this it? And he said, yes, this is the time. And off they went. So again, it wasn't just a spontaneous thing. It was, you know, conscious left-wingers playing that role. Now, the Communist Party and its various union officials played a key role in those two revivals of union activities. They also played a key role in digging us into the hole that we're in at the moment. And the key thing that they did was they sold the working class the Accord back in the 1983 at the start of the Labor government. The Accord was an agreement that basically that no industrial action would happen to pursue pay rises or to win better conditions, that everything, you know, every pay rise would be agreed at the top level between the ACTU, the bosses' organisations, and the government. And that was basically it. Over time, it became a vehicle for what was called award restructuring, and where, in order to get a pay rise, all of a sudden we have to give up conditions. There was a survey taken in, I think it was 1995, in the dying days of the Accord. Something like 50% of people said, I am working harder than I was last year. And this was going on year after year, and a lot of that was because of the sort of industry restructuring that was promoted under the Accord. Now, the reason for this, that the Communist Party, you know, they played such a good role in the 30s, was all of a sudden selling this class collaboration with disastrous results, I think is twofold. First of all, the Communist Party never really dealt with Stalinism. It drifted away from the Moscow line after Moscow, you know, intervened into Hungary in 56 and then Czechoslovakia into 1968, but they never really dealt with the fundamental question of what was wrong with the Soviet Union. And drifting away from Stalinism, they simply drifted towards the more mainstream ideas in society, mainstream social democracy and acceptance of capitalism. The second thing that had gone on, though, was that really the Communist Party, you can say in a lot of ways, had been captured by the union bureaucracy. Now, I talked about the communists going into the miners' union positions in 1934. Bill Orr was the one of the major figures there. There's one thing when there's a rising level of radicalisation, when you've got an organisation behind you on the ground, when you've got some decent communist politics, you're there in a programme of class struggle, and, you know, like the result was that strike in 1938. But if you're a union official for year after year after year after year, and some of these Communist Party union officials had been officials for decades by the time the Accord came along, this has to have a conservatising effect. And eventually they became, and really after the crisis, the economic crisis hit in 1975, it wasn't so easy to be a militant anymore. You couldn't just go out and win a pay rise by taking your members out on strike. And there was a very sharp change to, away from class struggle and towards, you know, we need an industry package. We need everyone to sit around the table to preserve our members' jobs. The end result of that process was the Accord of 1983. And it had an absolutely disastrous result, this class collaboration. Wages still fell steadily in the first years of the Accord, along with industrial action. There was a sort of work intensification that I talked about and so on. Of course, just because our side stops fighting, it doesn't mean that the other side stops fighting. And there was a series of, you know, pitched class battles in the 1980s under the Accord, where basically only one side was fighting. In 1985, Joe Bjelke-Petersen sacked the entire staff, or all of the linesmen who worked for SEQEB, the Southeast Queensland Electricity Board, like our SEC down here, and the ACTU stood back in the name of class peace and the Accord, did nothing to support these workers. In 1986, there was a similar battle out at Robe River, where thousands of not just miners, but you know everyone who worked at this particular Pilbara mine was sacked and then re-employed in different duties. So you had people who were like tea ladies who were now out in the hot Pilbara sun, being required to do manual work. This was an exercise in breaking the union, in showing management's right to manage, and again, union officials, almost to a person, refused to fight back. That was what set the scene for the dramatic decline in union coverage in the 1980s, which was the fastest. I mean, there's similar histories and similar declines going on in other industrialised countries, but Australia won the gold medal for the most rapid rate of decline of unionisation, and that was under the Accord. It fell from 48-49% in 1982 to something like 31% of the workforce in unions by the time Howard got elected. Now, we talk about a mass socialist party aspiring to be the memory of the class, remembering how our battles have been fought and won in the past, and so we can apply that lesson in the future. The reformist parties really play the role of the collective amnesia. So having led people to defeat and demoralisation through the 1980s and into the 1990s, what did we get under the Howard years? Really, more of the same. That really is the tragedy of it. Okay, I was going to talk about the MUA as a time when union struggle really burst back onto the scene. If someone had said at the start of 1998, oh yeah, by the way, in the week after Easter, you're going to be building barricades down at the docks. There's going to be thousands of construction workers and everyone else down there. We're going to be staring down the cops all night, and you're going to actually win and save a union. I would have said, okay, sort of slipped off. But that's pretty much what happened in 1998. The tragedy was that as soon as, and we won that dispute, we held up the docks and we won that dispute. The workers went marching through the gate. Then Greg Combe from the ACTU gets his shiny black shoes under the negotiating table, negotiates away every single condition that those bosses were after. So now you talk to workers down at the docks, like I've talked to workers down there who have been casual for 9 years, And so people say, so it was a real case of defeat snatched from the jaws of victory. That was a real opportunity to, it was such a popular dispute. The MUA has such a history of supporting progressive causes, the struggle against apartheid, struggle against the Vietnam War, you name it, they were there. Everyone wanted to support the MUA. The officials worked overtime to rein that solidarity action in. Okay, and that's the tragedy of it. So, I guess to wind up, there's nothing necessary about the decline of Australian unions. It's happened as a result of particular strategies pursued by our union officials. It's happened also because we haven't had the sort of network that we need to take those officials on and to argue convincingly for a different sort of approach and to put that perspective into action. So can Australian unions revive? Well, of course I'd say yes. Yes, because we still have 1.8 million members. Yes, because surveys say that the majority of people would rather be in a union, even though the majority aren't. But also yes, because we're not dodos. We're not 3-foot flightless birds stuck on Madagascar with a whole lot of men with guns. We're not dinosaurs. We're not, creatures brain the size of a walnut trying to adapt as a satellite or a comet or something crashes into the earth. We are human beings. And yes, we have lived thousands of years under class society and a couple of hundred years under this version of capitalism. Every time we have found a way to rebuild and to fight back. And sometimes that's taken a while. Sometimes that's taken a generation, when we're first herded into the factories and we're trying to work out what the hell's going on. Sometimes it takes a while to adapt to new conditions and find ways to fight back. But are we capable of it? Absolutely. Yes, we can. What form that will take, when that will happen, well, that, really we don't know, and I don't think there's a great deal of point in speculating. But we do know that it will be a painful process. We do know that it will involve defeats as well as victories. We do know every union revival has started with a small minority that has taken a stand, and that galvanises people and transforms the political situation. And we do know that politics is crucial to it. Because I hope I've demonstrated that, especially from the story of the miners and so on, politics is not incidental to the struggle. Politics is essential. If we want that union struggle to revive in the long term, We need to go about the business of educating ourselves and building an organisation that can play that sort of role that the communists played in the 30s. I'll leave it there.